Hello everybody and welcome to this week's Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the programme for teachers, policymakers and anyone with an interest in teaching and learning. I'm Sean Delaney and you can download podcasts of previous programmes by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the Podcasts tab. Last weekend, the annual conference of the Educational Studies Association of Ireland took place at University College Dublin. I was happy to attend there and I spoke to some of the presenters and I'll be bringing you some of their ideas in the coming weeks, beginning today. Pádraig Hogan is a senior lecturer in education at Maynooth University and is a former president of the Educational Studies Association of Ireland. His early experiences as a teacher have shaped the interests and research questions he has pursued since then. Among his interests are justice and equity in educational practice, professional ethics in teaching, and educational reform and its cultural contexts. When I met up with Pádraig, I first asked him a broad question. What is school for?
In the best terms, a school could be a place where students can go and feel safe and feel challenged and feel maybe that they can venture an idea even if an idea is wrong. It should be a learning environment which values plurality, the wide diversity of students, and offers them opportunities for learning, for fruitful learning, that mightn't otherwise be available. Now, having said all of that, what schools have been used for, Sin Scéalaithe.
And could you say a little bit about how they have been used? Because I think what you said there sounds very child-centred and student-centred, but in fact, governments are paying for schools and for education for a reason.
Yes. I would say even if you go back to Greek times, when Aristotle would have said that we must make education public because we cannot leave it up to the o economia, the household, we have to bring it out into the public domain. And then from that time, you could say that the very powerful interests, the state interests or the powers that be, you can call them that, church, state, commercial powers, they have always looked to education as something that would serve a strategic goal of maybe of a political kind, of an economic kind, of a religious kind, and they think they always will. Speaking as a teacher, if I'm working in a school, I would hope to be able to keep these forces, not all of them are malign, some of them are benign, but to keep them at bay sufficiently and to avail of them sufficiently to help a learning environment. But it's quite difficult. There's a big job for educational leadership in there as well and for putting supports in place. But I'd be a democrat, and I would say it's very important that the good of society is promoted in schools, but the good of society, whose version of the good of society? You know? So I'm a democrat, but also maybe a pluralist. So if you believe in plurality at all, you have to acknowledge that the school has a job to do working with plurality, with the whole diversity of humankind. And for that reason, I would say it's better to have plurality within the school than a plurality of different kinds of schools.
So when you're talking about plurality within the school, what do you mean by that?
Plurality in terms of gender, ability, if you like, sexual orientation, religious background, ethnic background. If you take plurality seriously, Martin Buber has this lovely phrase, the educator goes into the room and he sees them there. The misshapen, the bright, the dull, whatever, and accepts them all. Accepts them all. And that idea of accepting them all, not the ones that you might be naturally taken to, but those who are damaged, weakened, or whatever, you say, you have to accept them all.
And what about if educating everybody compromises the education of others, of the education they might otherwise get?
There's a big question there, and when, if you like, special schools were kind of done away with, I won't quite say done away with, they were replaced by, for instance, providing resources and special needs within the school, within the ordinary school, the mainstream school. A lot of people complained about that because they say our children are suffering because of the presence of these other children in the classroom. And that's an argument that has to be engaged with. So I think one has to gather the evidence, and I think the evidence, there's a second thought being given on this now by even people who are very much in favour of, mainstreaming all plurality within the same school. I think there are some students who do need a special kind of learning environment, perhaps because of medical conditions or whatever they have, special needs that they have, because having them in the same environment as others damages others and themselves. But I would say, I think the evidence to date would say that there is a need for a special kind of provision, but I still would say that it's an exception rather than something that should be writ large in educational policy.
And that brings me to another area of interest of yours then, which is the whole area of truth and ethics. Given that we live in a time when people talk about multiple truths, is it still worth seeking out the truth, which was what Socrates called the highest aspiration of human learning?
I'm not that keen on the idea of multiple truths. That can lead you very quickly to relativism. Your truth is as good as mine or mine. Now, if you have an idea, I would say, look, if the gods probably know it all. We don't. We're human. If we were immortal and eternal, we could possibly have an omniscient overview. Because we don't have that, it behoves us to listen to others, to find out more, to acknowledge the biases in our own perspective to date. Even if we were to live 10 lifetimes, there would still be biases in there. So working with others, with that kind of ear, if you like, listening attentively to what they have to say, joining a conversation, opening up new imaginative neighbourhoods, there's an ethics involved in that. It's an ethics of listening, an ethics of sharing, an ethics of opening up new landscapes, whether it's in literature, science or whatever, and pursuing new questions on the road to truth. But I think it was Karl Popper quoting Xenophanes, says, as for certain truth, no man has it, he says. All is but a woven web of guesses, but we can find out more through a discipline of critiquing our best efforts to date collectively.
So how do we know then that we're getting closer to the truth? Because in the past, we would have had maybe religion to guide us, or mm-hmm. we would have had, you know, some religion in particular. But nowadays, religion certainly doesn't have the same widespread acceptance. Yeah. So what is there to guide people searching for the truth?
I think the notion I'd like to introduce here is probably that of justified warrant. Because I could say, look, we can make progress so that I can discover some of the biases, some of the shortcomings that were in my previous understanding, but say, suppose it was in maths or science, by listening to you, my teacher, or whatever. So progress can be made, and we can look at evidence, but it remains provisional. The idea of making progress means that we know more than we did before. We are advancing something towards something that might be called truth, or a bigger picture, if you like. But I don't know that we'll ever get the fuller picture. But the idea of making progress, critiquing our own best efforts, and that idea of truth as provisional to the best of our fallible knowledge to date, that's the kind of criterion that I would put there.
So what I hear you saying is that we need to remain open mm-hmm. and we need to be searching, but we also need to remain critical. Mm-hmm. And how do we balance openness and criticality in terms of our individual searches for the truth?
No, I think that is what's involved in becoming a teacher. Because if I'm not open, and if I don't become a discerning critic of my own and others' work, then I think teaching is the wrong place for me. I don't see teaching as a transmission model. I say it's opening up collective learning environments, pursuing the truth, teacher not as a facilitator, but as somebody, a responsible leader, opening up there and keeping people on task and keeping people going in that way. That's a lifelong process of becoming. Being a teacher is not something that you suddenly become after you're qualified. Becoming a teacher is something that you do all your life. So it's a lifelong learning job. It's a shlivaha rather than a garamvaha, if I can put it that way. It's a way of life, which is different than the banker's way of life, or we'll say an architect's way of life, or a pharmacist's way of life, good and all as they are. So it means being human in a different kind of way.
Could you say a little bit more about teaching as a way of life? Because that's something you have written about in before, about learning as a way of life and teaching as a way of life. If we take teaching as a way of life first.
Yes, I think teaching is a way of life. The reason I came to that is because some people would have said teaching, oh, it's just a job like any other jobs. And I says, no. Others would say it's a vocation. And I have some sympathy with that. But in the Irish context, a vocation is something that you could be called on to do something, you know, by a superior. It was very often seen in a religious context. And some very, very good nuns, priests and others did an awful lot of work for the greater and glory of God because they were asked to do it by the superior. It's your vocation. So I said, I want to put that aside as well. I would say, look, it's a way of life which allows you to be human as an inquirer, as a listener, as a co-inquirer with others. And that's the idea I'm after there. Because one's own picture of the world isn't complete, one needs completion and critique from others, whether as a mathematician, a scientist, a geographer, or whatever.
But a nurse could say the same, or a dentist, or a doctor, or, you know, a plumber might say, like, I'm here and I want to live a fully human life as well. So how is the teaching life different from other...
I think you're right, actually, about the others. The lifelong learning idea is crucially important in these other occupations. But for teachers, there's the extra responsibility of enabling others to join this conversation and maybe not to become bigoted, to remain open to people of different colours, different genders, you know, different sexual orientations, and to have that kind of openness as part of one's formative years. As a teacher, I have a responsibility to try to keep the learning environment hospitable in that way. Now, the nurse, she has to do something else. She doesn't have this specific responsibility, although she might have. There might be some parallels.
And supposing the teacher's their own searching leads them in a direction which moves them away from openness or moves them away from criticality, is that a problem?
I think it is. I think it is, because the consequences of that are likely to show themselves in the learning environment. And there are very many instances of that throughout history, where a teacher who becomes certain in his way, I have the truth, I'll transmit the truth to the others, I'll correct their errors, whether it's, you have Stalinist versions of that, you have fundamentalist religious versions of it. And there could be tendencies in that direction in all of us. So they need to be watched in teaching.
And isn't it funny, we don't really consciously talk about preparing teachers to discern that balance between openness and criticality.
I think we do. Well, look, a lot of our own work, say, at pre-service, and I would say what used to be called in-service, now continuing professional development, that is probably the number one priority, to ensure that we can retain an open, and I would say a venturesome learning environment, where it is safe to venture, where ideas maybe from off the wall even are welcome, so long as nobody is being ridiculed. So building a learning environment, it is a very subtle art, where respect for everybody there, but also where everybody understands there are going to be critical questions here asked. You're not going to be criticised, but the ideas that are going to be pulled out there on the floor are open for criticism by all of us in respectful ways.
So could you bring us inside that venturesome learning environment then, and like let us see what's going on inside it?
Okay. A concrete example maybe would... Let's take teaching of Shakespeare in school. When I was a youngster in school, I got thoroughly fed up of Shakespeare, but put me off him until I was in the B class, but I could hear one day through the partition that separated us from the A class next door, the teacher in there was saying, I shall speak daggers to her, but use none. Now, he was auditioning some of the students in the class. You know, I shall speak daggers to us. I said, God, this is great. He was opening up Shakespeare. I said, this drama. And because I was listening through the door, I said, God, that maybe there's more in this Shakespeare. Maybe this is what it should be about, opening up a drama. And of course, now I'll never miss a Shakespeare play if I can see it. But really, so many people get turned off Shakespeare, turned off maths, because the subject has not been opened up in that way. And there again, I say, the transmission model, Leaving Cert is not hospitable to it. High stakes exams are not hospitable to it. But if you genuinely want to do service, good service to the author, whether it be Shakespeare, whether it's science or whatever, you need to open up the environment and enable students to become more at home in that environment, i.e. more fluent.
But once you open it up to them, don't you also want then to make them more discerning, that they're not open to everything and that they can actually see that Shakespeare is different to, say, some trashy play?
Yes, and to know the reasons why. The subtleties, the insight, the kind of little bits of rhyme that is in there, the little body bits, the pure artistic creation, the coming together, you know, of all that, of genius, really, and beginning to appreciate that in subtle ways, which gradually builds a love of the subject. Now, having said that, I would say not everybody will respond to all of these voices in the same way. Somebody might say, might take to Shakespeare, another person might take to music, another person to woodwork, whatever. The profile of promise is different in the plurality. So that's something that we need to understand as teachers as well. The profile of promise is different in each one. So I'd like to think of a classroom, I'm going to use a deliberate one here, as a profusion of human flourishing. It's a flowery idea, if you like, but really it's an aim in view that I would have as a teacher, and that's why I say it's as a way of life. Now, that doesn't mean that I mightn't sometimes be very, very strict, because to protect the environment that we're doing there, if somebody does something and says, sorry, that's a red card offence, we have to have a word about that later. And everybody begins to understand what the red card offence is. They won't be ridiculed there, but they will be talked to and brought through something afterwards.
What is your understanding of learning as a way of life?
I cannot be a teacher unless I'm a learner first. That is a problem, I think, with a lot of the older view, that I'm a teacher, I'm the person who knows, so therefore I don't have to learn anymore. Now, that sounds very stark, but there would be a lot of colleagues, and we would have come across them in schools, and say, look at my track record. I've got maths points, got all my kids through school. I don't have to learn anymore. I worry when I hear that, because that means that that teacher doesn't perceive the need to learn, to become a learner again. So if I don't see myself as a learner, then I should have second thoughts about remaining a teacher.
In 1983, you wrote an article on the central role of prejudice in the supervision of student teachers. Yes. What was that article about?
I would have been conscious, and I think many would at the time, of being supervised as a student teacher by Mr. X or Miss Y, and you'd be saying, well, he's very good on this, he's very bad, and you'd want to watch out for the prejudices. And so there was a move away from that towards criteria. But even with criteria, you will never get rid fully of where a teacher is coming from. So the teacher has to say that the place of prejudgment, if you like, we always, and I think
this is where the supervisor, the assessor is coming from.
Exactly. Yeah. So the supervisor needs to know where the supervisor is coming from. The supervisor needs to be involved in criterion-based discussions, seminars with colleagues, and be ready to be corrected by the student teacher, and needs to work with the student teacher in such a way that the student teacher can see, look, this is governed by criteria, this is how I'm going after these criteria, so that the prejudgment of the teacher can be re-educated. So if I'm going in, I might learn something from my students, but I will never be able to go in as a supervisor from a place that is presuppositionless, because it is through our presuppositions that we understand.
So the important thing is to be aware of what prejudices you're bringing with you.
Yeah, insofar as possible. And there's so many of them behind our backs, you know, that it needs a dialogue to bring it out. And it's through a dialogue, sometimes maybe even through a confrontation, that it might come out.
And have your views on that changed since 83, or would you still hold the same views on that?
I would say probably more deeper now, but in a more tolerant way as well. Because when I came across that view in the beginning, I didn't welcome that view. I came across it in, say, Gadamer's work, German philosopher. And he has this phrase, it is not so much our judgments as it is our prejudgments that constitute us as human. I rejected that completely. I would have a rationalist view. Look, you have to get rid of prejudices and you start from a presupposition in this place. And the longer you live, the more you see everybody's coming from someplace. And there are so many tributaries to where people are coming from, that not all of them can be identified.
And it's so hard to know where you're coming from because it's so much part of you.
Exactly. But that's why dialogue with a plurality of people is so important. People who might shock you out of prejudices that you never had. So that's why I say include the plurality within the classroom.
But isn't it harder and harder to do that nowadays, because it's so easy to be in a community, especially online, of people who think broadly the same as you and who share the same interests as you, and that you're less likely now to encounter people who will pull you up a little bit and challenge you.
If you're a teacher, Sean, in a school, and I've gone back to work in a community school in Dublin every 5 years into a non-selective school, you know, and diversity still thrives there. It thrives. And the kind of diversity which can be sometimes very threatening, you know, really pupils who could damage your car in ways which mightn't be proved, you know. So there are real dangers there are risks involved there. But I think as well, becoming a teacher and being a teacher in the kind of environment I'm talking about, the supports that are needed for that are ones that wouldn't be the traditional supports that in-service education would have put in place. I do think it's very important to network with others, whether online or whatever, but to share experiences which are new, which are challenging, and to keep that kind of frisson, if you like, with new challenges alive. Otherwise, one gets into habits of complacency and, you know, it happens.
You've written about the tensions between difference and deference in human learning. What are those tensions?
Deference. There was too much deference in education traditionally. The child's job was to defer to the teacher. The teacher's job was to defer to authority within the school. Now, I'm not saying there shouldn't be any deference, but I think deference is an idea that has to be critiqued. It has to be questioned. If it's merely compliance, unquestioning obedience, then there's a difficulty with that. And in hierarchical schools, you know, there's still that kind of expectation. Everybody in a learning environment, in fact, in any workplace, comes from somewhere different. And the fact that one is in a position of authority shouldn't hide that fact. So when we say difference, people understand differently, so therefore there's going to be shortcomings in anyone's way, including the understanding of the pre-vigil, if you like, in the school. So that's what I was trying to get at there.
How do you see the relationship between ethics and education?
I think of education as a practice in its own right, if I can use that phrase. If it is a practice in its own right, it's a distinct practice, say from Socrates onwards, which enables people to come together and as communities inquirers. Now, an ethics is built into that already as a practice. Just as in, say, in medicine, there's an ethic built in, i.e. the Hippocratic Oath, you know, do not do harm to somebody, that's built into it. So anything that's worthy of the name of a practice has some kind of a built-in ethic in broad terms. Teaching, when it's genuinely the kind of practice that it should be, has an ethic built into it, a kind of commitment, something that I acknowledge when I see the faces of my students, and I do acknowledge them, and that the ethics is in there. There's something, this coming something close to what Martin Buber or Emmanuel Levinas would be saying now, recognizing the face of the other, but maybe the appeal or the condescension or, you know, when you're reading the faces of your students, that there is an ethic involved there. It's a subtle ethic of saying, asking you to respond, to help. That's the way I'm inclined to think of ethics, rather than here's a code of ethics that you must follow. That may have its place as well, but at a much deeper level, to be a teacher means to respond to others in this kind of way, to recognise that you're called on to respond.
So at a practical level then, what kind of ethical issues might arise for teachers in the course of doing their job from day to day?
Oh, I think so many of them, every minute, you know, they would say, look, did I put down that student? I thought I used gentle irony to that student. I may have been experienced as ridicule. You know, when I think about it afterwards, there would be issues like that, arising out of practice itself. So trying to ensure that justice is done to everyone in a school and that the learning environment stays open, stays hospitable to questioning, is becoming genuinely more fluent, that students aren't being left behind. You know, there are so many balls you have to keep in the air at the same time, that all of these are the ethical dimensions of teaching, and they're ever-present. So that if I become a good reader of my work, of my practice, these are things that will come up with me. Actually, if I could draw a comparison there, say if I'm a footballer or a camogie player or whatever, I watch the video on Tuesday after the Sunday game, you see, and I see where were the shortcomings there? How might I have done that better? And if the idea of reflective practice has a purchase with teachers, I think you can get it by comparing it to something that they are familiar with there. Because if you become a good reader of your own game on the field, then when the field is the classroom or the learning environment, you need to become a discerning, critical reader of your own game, including the shortcomings, including the opportunities that might have been missed, but they won't be missed the second time.
How would you guide a teacher in order to reflect on their practice from an ethical perspective?
Lecturing about ethics is the wrong way to do it, okay? And I can say that as somebody who began my life with lecturing in philosophy of education. But through the learning experiences which they undergo as student teachers, including the placement and the interrogation of the placement afterwards with the help of video and working in teams, these issues will come up. and we can make an agenda of these issues and interrogate them then, including gender issues in the classroom, put downs in the classroom, you know, favoritism. I responded to this pocket of the class only and not to the others. So, I didn't notice that, but you will see it in the video. So it's if you like, making a text of our own experience. That's a Socratic notion, actually. You know, when he says the unexamined life isn't worth living, it's the unexamined practice is not worth bothering about.
So, but it can be uncomfortable, too.
It could be. But that's why I think that, say, in teacher education, you need to sustain and to affirm students when they're taking maybe their first tenuous steps in this direction.
And what was your own route into teacher education?
I started teaching in a community stroke comprehensive school, and after a few years there I got an opportunity. I did a master's actually while I was there, but that school had come together as an amalgamation between an academic secondary school and a new kind of school where children from large corporation estates were. But it didn't work. Everybody was going to the same school, but they were going to different schools within the school, if I can put it that way, and they knew it. So I said, there's something deeply wrong here, I thought. So a lot of the issues, even the ones that I've talked to you about now, had their birth back there. So later, when I got the opportunity to do the doctorate, and I did that, finished it in 77, and I had a big hole in my pocket, so I had to take a job, I think it was the National Council for Educational Awards for a few years, which paid more than teaching at the time, but it enabled me to get financially independent. And then this job was advertised for Maynooth, a lecturer in the education department. I applied for that, and that was 82, and I've been in Maynooth since.
And that account of how Pádraig Hogan became a teacher educator brings this week's Inside Education to a close. I recorded the interview with Pádraig at this year's annual conference of the Educational Studies Association of Ireland, which was held in UCD last weekend. I hope you enjoyed this week's programme. If you did, please spread word about it to your colleagues and friends. Remember, you can download over 320 Inside Education podcasts by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the Podcasts tab. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from online bookshops, and you can order it from your local library. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.